Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And our guest today is Sandra Marchetti. And Sandra is a poet. She's the 2023 winner of the Twin Bill Book Prize for Best Baseball Poetry Book of the Year, and is the author of two full-length collections of poetry, Aisle 228, which was the baseball poetry, and Confluence, and now a third, Diorama. She's also the author of four chapbooks of poetry and lyric essays, and her poetry has appeared widely in Blackbird, Ecotone, Subtropics, Poet Lore, and elsewhere. And her essays can be found in The Rumpus, Mid-American Review, Whiskey Island, and other venues. Sandra is the poetry editor emerita at River Styx magazine. She earned an MFA in creative writing poetry from George Mason University and now serves as the assistant director of academic support at Harper College in the Chicagoland area. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Sandra.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start out with your Iowa City connection.
Yeah.
So I understand you're going to be in Iowa City this summer.
Yes.
And
yes.
Tell us, what brings you here? Have you been here before? And what you'll be doing?
Okay. So a few different things, right? Like, I think a mutual friend of ours, Michael Cotton, is the one who introduced us virtually. And Michael, as you might know, is a podcaster himself. He does a podcast for a Chicago Cubs fan podcast called The Sun Ranto Show with another friend of mine, Danny Rocket, which I've been grateful to appear on a couple different times. It's very different than a writer's podcast, but it's a lot of fun. So he's someone I know in Iowa City, and he's the one who kind of made this connection. But also, Iowa City Poetry and Porch Light Literary are two wonderful organizations in Iowa City that were so gracious to have me, maybe last year or the year before, come out and read from Aisle 228. Jennifer McBain Stevens is involved with them, and she's a fantastic person that I know from George Mason, actually. And this summer, June 14th and 15th, I'll be back in Iowa City leading the Free Gen workshop on the 15th through Iowa City Poetry. And then also on the 14th, I'll be giving a reading from my new book, Diorama. So I'm really excited to come back. It's such a vibrant community, of course. And I'm excited to see some old and new friends.
Where is the reading going to be?
Ooh, that's a good question. it might be at the Porch Light House. I'm not sure.
And what is the Porch Light?
It's a literary organization in Iowa City, and they do have a house. I don't know the city well enough to tell you exactly where it is, but they hold events there. They also put up writers there. I've stayed there before. So,
cool.
And I know they host other workshops.
June 14th and 15th?
June 14th and 15th. Yes.
Okay. All right. So Diorama, what is the meaning of the title? And, you know, this is a collection of poetry. Now, you know, the previous one all had a theme of baseball.
Yeah.
And is this one as thematically linked?
That's a great question. It's not. I would say for Aisle 228, I was able to, and I think this is rare, give basically an elevator pitch for the book of poems, right? It's about the Chicago Cubs. Listening to baseball on the radio and going to games with my dad, almost like, you know, you could a memoir. But for this book, Diorama, it's more similar to my first book of poems, Confluence, which, you know, it's been 10 years since that book was published. But in that there are themes and there are links, but it's not something I can sum up in a sentence. I will tell you the title holds sort of a key. So actually the cover of the book is a photograph of one of the Thorne miniature rooms at the Art Institute of Chicago, which is a diorama. Some people think it's just like a lovely foyer from a, you know, fancy house, but it's a picture of a diorama.
And now, diorama is, it's been a long time since I've even heard that word or thought about. I mean, like maybe since elementary school. So what exactly is a diorama?
A diorama is usually a scale model, a smaller scale model of something bigger. And oftentimes it's set within, like we think of the ones from elementary school, right, as like inside of a shoebox,
right,
or maybe a terrarium.
Oh, I loved making those.
Yes. Oh, they were amazing. And I mean, even if we think about dollhouses, the really fancy ones, right, in a way, in effect, they're sort of dioramas, right, where it's just it's a smaller version of something bigger. It's something you can go in and rearrange the pieces of. But it takes a different skill set to build the diorama than it does to build whatever real life thing it's modeled after. And to go back to the themes of the book, like the idea with the book, for me was, can I write some poems about my influences, or using lines and titles and poems of my influences, other poets I love, can I use them to create my own poems? So not just as an exercise. I think we're often told in poetry, like, pick a line of poetry you like, or try to model your poem after somebody else's, just as an exercise, just to see how you do. And for me, I really wanted to see if I could write my own poems, but incorporate my influences in one way or another. And that's what I really tried to do with the book. There's like a few pages of endnotes at the end of the book, which is really like a reading list of other poets you could read. And so I thought, you know, I'm thinking of my book as the diorama, right? It took a different skill set to write it, but it's also hearkening back to these other influences, these other people. And so that's a huge theme in this book.
Okay. I did notice those end pages, and I thought that was really cool. And that each one, you sort of were giving a little hint to the meaning of the poem, or the, inspiration for the poem. Mm-hmm. And I was curious why you chose to do them as endnotes rather than put it with the poem.
That's a great question. And I think for me, there are people who just love footnotes, right? And I think the book already had a lot of epigraphs, right? There were a lot of little quotes from people kind of splattered throughout at the tops of poems, like right under the title. And I think I felt like I didn't want the pages to become too cluttered. But also one thing I remember talking about a lot in grad school, and that was a long time ago now for me, but I remember us talking about, it's a stylistic choice, right? Whether to have endnotes or footnotes. And for me, I just felt like I didn't want folks to feel compelled to read that back matter. Like if they wanted to, fine, but I also wanted the poems to stand on their own for the most part. That okay. You could just go to a poem and you didn't necessarily have to know the reference. There are plenty of poems that do not have not every poem in there has an endnote attached to it. but I didn't want people to feel compelled or to feel like this is some sort of scholarly work where like I really have to follow up on these and check the sources, because it's not supposed to be that, you know, it's supposed to be literature. It's supposed to be something you can just read. So I think that was the thought.
Like you mentioned, there are some that have little, you know, epigraphs or little notes with the poem.
Yeah.
And for example, here's one, the poem titled The Book, and in quotes right underneath it, it says, "Glamour in retrospect involved false conception. Brian Detmer." Okay, so why in this case did you include it, where in another case you might have put that in the endnote?
Yeah, well, first of all, Brian Detmer is a wonderful I'm just going to give a very short plug for him. He's a wonderful visual artist who creates, who takes old books and cuts them up and glues them together and makes little scenes out of books that are really interesting and awesome. And I'd love for people to go and Google him. But I thought that that part of one of his works, because that was actually a line from one of his, you know, sort of erasures and cut-ups of an old book, really went well with what the poem was trying to say and almost served as like a first stanza for that poem, or some sort of epigraph that would be grounding in that case. Me telling you a poem is based on a painting or whatever, I feel like that sort of stuff, which does appear more in the endnotes, is less important. It's not language driven. With this, I felt like the language itself was poetic and interesting enough to include just right there on the page.
Do you want to read that poem for us?
Sure, absolutely. Okay, let me find it. Okay, 32. The book. Glamour in retrospect involved false conception. Brian Detmer. How much less did we expect of knowledge before you? In our hands, the bland foretelling. Left to right, we read until figures emerge. Between the parentheses, I smell the whole, open and decaying. Like dried bread, a greened coin or mold, I am at the center. A friend told me about her favorite library in India, how the books were eaten through with silverfish.
So is this kind of a tribute to books? As a way of conveying knowledge, and yet they're not all, it's not all beneficial knowledge, maybe, or?
I think it's definitely a tribute to books. I think it might be, sometimes our poems reveal themselves to us, and sometimes I think even as the writer, you want there to be some mystery there. But what I think of the poem really doesn't matter. It's what the reader makes of it that is the meaning. But I do think the idea here is to give all the sensory experiences of the book, especially maybe an old book, right? For me, like, images are not just visuals. Like, a good image includes other senses, taste, touch, smell. So I definitely am trying to incorporate some of those in here. And just this idea that, you know, holding the book and interacting with the book is a fully sensory experience. And it's also something that we, it's also like the mystery that we create, right? Our interaction with the book is what gives it the meaning, because we're making stuff up in our head as we're reading, you know? So I think there's a little bit of that.
You know, I've talked to various authors about over time, although less so as we've gotten more accustomed to it, but you know, the ebook, digital book versus physical mm-hmm. book, and how many, you know, there certainly a prediction, there was a prediction maybe 15 years ago that physical books would mm-hmm. almost disappear, that we'd all be mm-hmm. reading digitally, and that really has not happened.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I was at a event last night reading, and there was an open mic as well. And there were many young people who went up to the mic. And I mean, I hate to make some sort of generational, you know, but they were younger than me. They were in their 20s and they all had paper notebooks, you know, or leather notebooks. They had, you know, some of them had like post-it notes and pages sticking out of them. And I was surprised because I've definitely been to events where people read poems off their phone. but that was not the case. And I was like, wow, I'm really shocked. Person after person came up with their paper notebook.
I'm glad that you noticed that, because I think there is something very comforting about writing on paper. And, you know, there was this idea that we would even be able to write, you know, take notes manually, not have to type. There are tablets that you can write on and it records it. But I don't know anybody who does that.
Yeah,
I've thought about doing it, but I never have.
Well, if it's going to record your handwriting, what is the real difference anyway? I think there are programs that you can write and it will type it up. I don't know how accurate they are. I've never used them myself.
Yeah. I just Googled as we were talking about whether fewer physical books were being published now than in 2000. Mm-hmm. And now this is AI's answer, so make of it what you will. But no, the number of physical books is not significantly lower than in 2000.
Interesting.
In fact, the number of books published has increased dramatically in recent years.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I would say that means more books are being read, because certainly people are reading digital books as well as physical books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could definitely be. I definitely think there's a move toward, there aren't a lot of cheap paperbacks being published anymore, right? Like when you buy a book, I think it's sort of this cherished object, you know, it's looked at as this, and I think this is true, like, I don't really teach anymore, but I manage a tutoring center at a community college, and the students that I have, who work in my area, I mean, I think they see those physical objects as something to be cherished, because it's different than, you know, just
it's something
the
of value.
Screens they use for everything else. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Now, poetry is certainly one type of book that doesn't really transfer to digital format all that well.
It can be a struggle. I'll put it that way. I've published in several online literary magazines that have struggled to format, whether it's my work or someone else's work, you know. And the thing about poetry that's great for the age we live in is it's easy to read. It's, you know, takes but a minute of your time, you know. and, you know, I always stress to people who, like when I wrote a book of poems about baseball, a lot of my readers were not people who read poetry. They were baseball fans. And I tried to, and honestly, they loved the book, which was wonderful. But some of them worried about, you know, it's poetry. I haven't read poetry since high school, or I didn't even read it in high school. And I'd say, you know, the great thing about poetry is you, and I think I've already said this on this interview, but, you know, you don't have to get a certain meaning from it. You know, whatever you're able to glean, whatever stands out to you, whether it's a meaning or just something you'll remember, an image you liked, that's enough. You know, that is more than enough. So
English teachers, we've all had English teachers. Some of us have been English teachers. Yeah. When you're teaching poetry in a class and you're trying to get the class to decipher the poem and get to what did the author mean here. And I remember sitting in the class and thinking, I wonder if the author really had this intent, or if it was, because when I write, some of it's intentional, but sometimes the language just sort of takes a life of its own, and you get something, some meaning that someone could get out of it that wasn't the author's intent at all.
Oh, for sure. And I do think that when we're writing, part of the delight of the process is that we surprise ourselves. Mm-hmm. There are things there that we didn't expect to be there. That's the beauty of it. You know, like I think even like Stephen King in, you know, his, what is it on writing, right? I think he's said, like, if you've got it all planned out, you're doing it wrong. And in novels, we know you need plot charts. You need some of that to write a novel, but he's still saying to surprise yourself. So for sure. And I think I really think most poets would tell you, like, whatever you're getting out of it is just fine. In fact, I work with a lot of poets on manuscript consultations, and oftentimes I'll tell them, you're over-explaining here, especially readers of poetry. They want to make their own meanings. They want there to be a little bit of mystery. If you're hitting it, the nail on the head and hammering it home, it's probably too much. Right. You don't, right, you know, this isn't a five right. paragraph essay where you need to state your thesis and then state it again and state it again, you know.
Now, you know, poetry, writing poetry is probably not very commonly a way to make a living.
Absolutely not.
and so I certainly can understand what drives people to write poetry, but like for you to get a degree in poetry, what it's motivated you to do that? And what was
You're
your
starting to sound like my father. Sorry, please continue.
No, just yeah, what you know, what were you that's a lot of effort to put into something.
Sure. Yeah, no, I was listening to your last episode with Lindsay Rush, and she was talking about her friends with MFAs and how she's a self-taught poet. And, you know, I think that that is a more than worthy way to go about it. For me, I was 23 years old. I was 22, and I was graduating from college, and I knew this was really what I wanted to do because it was something I loved so much, and I had great teachers in my undergrad. But there was also value for me, in getting a master's degree because I also knew I wanted to work in higher ed in some capacity. And I was going to need a master's degree to do that. So there was sort of double motivations there. I wanted to study poetry for 3 years. I also wanted to get some sort of job in higher ed. So there was sort of a means to an end there too. I would tell anybody who wants to go get an MFA, please, please do not go into debt for it. You know, there are teaching assistantship programs. And I mean, we are in a changing political landscape, but mine was paid for through the school. So I also felt like, you know, I can do this. This isn't okay. You know, I lived on a shoestring, but I could do it.
Right.
And, you know, I knew I would be writing poetry. Like, I think the MFA is a way to figure out if you're really going to do something. In my bachelor's program, one of my mentors said, well, you'll go to the master's degree and you'll decide if this is something you really want to do. And I'm like, I'm going to spend 3 years after committing to that and then decide if this is something I really want to do. But it's true. Like, I mean, there are a lot of people I graduated with in my master's program who are not writing poetry anymore. They're doing other creative things, or they're maybe taking a break. But for me, it was a really good way for me to figure out, like, how can I be a writer after this and give me a foundation for how I could then go ahead and continue to be a writer in my life, you know, after the MFA. So
you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Sandra Marchetti, author of Diorama and also Aisle 228. We're talking about both those books here today. So it seems like almost all of the poems in here, how many poems are in this collection in Diorama?
I believe there's about 50, maybe 60, probably not 60, maybe about 50.
How do you decide what poems to include in a collection like this?
Yeah, that's a good question. So
I'm guessing this isn't like every poem you've written.
you Well, it's interesting because I'm going to keep referencing your last episode because I just thought it was great. And it's a contrast in styles, right? You were talking to Lindsay and she talked about writing 180 poems and then her editor chose some, the best ones to go in. For me, almost every poem I did write is in this book over that 10-year period. Wow. So I'm just a different style of writer. You know, there's no good or bad or right or wrong. But I think for me, I'm very slow and I'm extremely methodical with my revision. You know, each poem probably gets revised a few dozen times, if not more, maybe. Some of them, I would say it's probably more like 50 or 60 times.
Do you know when you're done?
I think there's a combination of factors there. Like, I think, first of all, how does the poem sound? I'm a very oral poet, and I mean that with an O and an A. You know, when I read it out loud, does it sound right? How is the rhythm? Am I catching on anything like that I don't want to be? Also, you know, have I been able to make my images as clear as I want them to be? And sometimes I want them to be muddy, but in the right ways, you know? Mm-hmm. But I'm extremely language focused, you know, and I think that's one thing that separates poetry from prose, because you asked Lindsay that too. And I think the idea there is, I really want every word to be picked with the utmost of care for the rhythm, for the exact image I'm trying to portray. And oftentimes I know when it's done, you know, something will just click, where I realize, like, okay, we've reached that point. Oftentimes the poems start off bigger and they're revised down to something a little more compressed. So yeah.
Now, most of the poems in this book are fairly short.
Yes.
Yeah. And yeah. Some of them are very short.
Yes.
Is it necessarily any quicker to write a short poem than a long one?
I don't know. You know, I've never been a person like you. You probably have to ask somebody who writes 10-page poems or verse length books. That's got to be really hard. I'll blame my own attention span and just say I don't really like reading poems that are very long. I'm sorry. I just don't like it. I like a short sort of like snapshot type of poems. And so I write what I like. But it is really hard. And I think there are a lot of poets who I've met and talked to who would say, you know, how can you condense it down to that few 50 words or 100 words? Like, and I'm like, well, I don't say anything twice, you know, and I'm not using a lot of adjectives, you know, like
right,
I'm a very
right.
verby poet, you know, so that's part of it. But I mean, it took me 10 years to write the poems in this book. So it's still time consuming and it's still difficult. I mean, even if they're not long.
Well, you know, one of my favorite authors of all time was Mark Twain. And
yes, of course.
He has there's a famous quote from a letter that he wrote where he said, you know, I don't remember who he was writing to, but dear so-and-so, I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have time.
Yes. Yes. And I think a lot of prose writers, you know, like I've written a good amount of prose, especially essays and articles. And there's usually a word limit. Like I work with editors and there's a word limit. And that is really difficult. And it's not something that poets encounter very often. This idea of like, we need 500 words on this or 1,000 words on that. But I'll blame that part of my writing life on the poems and just saying, okay, how can we streamline this to the point where you're getting exactly what you need and no more?
Nothing you know? Unnecessary.
Yes.
Why don't you share another poem with us?
Sure. I'll be happy to read the poem that mentions dioramas. That might be useful, right?
Perfect.
And it's early on in the book, Semblance. Easter's pale pink, green, lilac, blue. I mute you. I will not sing across the hay-thatched grass as the songbirds do. I see in the hue of a winter not yet gone. The sun slips from stripped trees, and between the irises, Glick does not remember the daffodils, gentle in their clusters, clutching at the yellows of their throats. A couple playing catch slides from view. Still, the diorama assembles. The scene runs true.
Okay. I'm trying to semblance. It's beautiful. I'm not sure what you're writing about. What was the spark for this?
I think the idea of something maybe looking one way but not being exactly what it seems.
Okay.
Right.
And you're referencing Louise Glick's The Wild Iris. So would it help me if I were familiar with that?
Maybe. In The Wild Iris, all the poems are written in the voices of flowers in her garden. So it's a really interesting collection. That's pretty opaque too. Just from picking up the book, you might not totally get that.
Okay.
For her book, right? But one flower that I think is not mentioned is the daffodil. But in this particular scene, there are daffodils.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. And they are the first flowers to bloom oftentimes, you know, depending where you are in the country.
Of course.
And
the irises are just now in full force, by the way, as we're speaking on May 22nd. Yeah. One batch right outside my window is done. Actually, most of the ones in my garden are done, but I still see others around town.
Yeah, we have some purple irises here. Some are blooming and some are done, and some are not behaving and don't have buds this year.
I know. Irises are tricky. It's interesting because it's very coincidental. I recorded another interview today with Jill Bielowski, who wrote a memoir of her mother, Iris. And so we were talking about irises in that one too, and the cover of her book.
Oh, wow.
Irises.
Oh, it is beautiful. Really beautiful book.
It is. And this is the day for irises, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I think the idea of, you know, perhaps being in a situation where things look one way or they feel one way, but they're not as they seem. I think that's all the poem's really trying to convey. Like, you can see a scene where people are outside. There are people playing catch in this poem. Like, you know, the baseball never really leaves, right? There's a little bit of that right here. But I think just the idea that, like, you know, someone can feel one way, but things look another way. Maybe things look bright and beautiful and, you know.
And how does that connect with the diorama, with the idea of diorama?
Well, I do think there's kind of that same idea there, that the diorama is not exactly the same as the thing it portrays, right? It's a little bit different. It's a little bit of it's maybe a study for a larger piece, but it's also just its own piece of art. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be modeled after something bigger, or, you know, certainly the skills it takes to make is not the same as the larger.
Right.
Yeah. So
it makes, when you talk about that, it makes me think of this TV show I just watched. I think it was The Residence. It was set in the White House, and it's this murder mystery, and it's amazing. But there's a diorama of a model of the White House, and somebody put in the little butler who got killed with a knife in him in this diorama.
That's cool. No, I love things like that, or like Clue, you know, I love Clue as a kid. Yeah. So
baseball, you obviously are quite a baseball fan.
I am.
And how did that start? And how does that inspire your poetry?
Yeah, so there's maybe if anybody's been mystified by the first half of this podcast, the second half, I think there's a little more of a narrative through line. So it's a little bit easier for, you know, for some folks, I think. Yeah, so I've been going to games, Chicago Cubs games and other baseball games, let's just be honest, with my dad since I was a little kid, actually with both of my parents. But now I mostly go with my dad, who is in his 70s, and we go to about 8 to 12 Cubs games a year, I would say, but I watch all the games on TV. And I've been a Cubs fan since I was really very small. And this was a way for me to connect with my father. Like, we would watch the games together. I'm an only child. And, you know, I think my father and I, when we go to games together, people turn around and they're like, you really know your stuff. And I feel like there's some sexism there, but we talk like scouts, you know, like I think that's how we sound to some people, at least. We follow the team that closely. So, and we love it. And for me, ever since I published my first book of poetry in 2015, I knew my next book would probably be this book of baseball poems that I wanted to write. Because I had known since I wrote my first baseball poem in high school. And there is a poem in this book that references that first baseball poem. But I knew that it was something I found inspiring and something I found awfully beautiful and poetic. And there is, you know, it's a great metaphor for life, right? The losing, the winning, the advancing on the bases, there's almost a religious fervor to it, all of these things. And I had a lot to say. And then the Chicago Cubs won the World Series and I had more to say. And so I said, okay, this book is really happy. You know, I maybe had 30 poems in 2016 when the Cubs won the World Series. And I said, you know, I have plenty more to write here. And so that's kind of how the book came.
Because
to be.
The book is in two sections, losers and winners. And first, anyone who maybe is not that familiar with baseball or with the Chicago Cubs, they didn't win a World Series for how many years?
It was 108 years between titles. So, yes, a long time. And they were called the lovable losers. So that first section is kind of calling back to that for sure.
Now, were they weren't always bad, though.
No, they weren't always bad. I mean, there were great years, right? There were wonderful. I think a lot of people believed they would win the World Series in 1984. I think they went to a World Series in 1945, I believe. They won a pennant in 1945, but they lost. There were great years, but they were not always consistent. And there were years where I think fans thought, you know, there was no hope for them. Yeah.
So how are they doing this year so far?
They're good. You know, I'm going to totally jinx things by talking about it on this podcast, but you know, they're in first place right now in their division and they're playing really well. Offense is dynamic. They're scoring lots and lots of runs, which I think is the main ingredient in their current success. So,
all right. All right. Would you like to share a poem from aisle 228?
For sure.
And by the way, what does aisle 228 mean?
Yes. So another cryptic meaning, right? Not really. No, this is an easy one to understand. So the seats that my father and I sat in for many, many years were in aisle 228. So that was the section of the seats down the first base line. There were box seats that we sat in for, you know, 20 plus years. Now we sit in a different section and it's long long story as to why, but I kind of wrote the book, at least some of the poems and the poems about Wrigley, from the perspective of sitting in those seats. So kind of like looking out on the field from that section, from that vantage point.
Okay.
Yeah, so let's see here. I think I'm going to read, I'm going to have to find it, one of those poems that looks out from those seats. Over Sheffield Avenue, after John Thorne. I'm playing baseball in the Garden of Eden. Scratch that. I'm riding baseball in the Garden of Eden, where old cars ride street corner curves in our square city while vendors hawk peanuts. I'm riding baseball out of the Garden of Eden. Clouds sail the blue gold lake, a tincture Titian never mastered. Players skim the surface grass in pinstriped cottons. Blue hats, blue socks, blue numbers. I'm riding baseball out of the garden. I touch the field to liquefy it, a prism painted deftly on my eye. I'm riding baseball as it never was, from a Sunday on which we won it all.
Aha. So Sheffield Avenue is...
Yeah, so... You know, Waveland and Sheffield are the two, like, you know, Clark and Addison are the streets that are talked about as like the front door to Wrigley Field. But Waveland and Sheffield are the two streets that box in Wrigley from the outfield, right?
Okay.
So over Sheffield Avenue would be, I think, right field.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And John Thorne?
John Thorne is the official historian of Major League Baseball. So that is his job title. And I'm jealous, you know. But he wrote a book. And you don't need to know this to understand this poem, I don't think. But he wrote a book called Baseball in the Garden of Eden about the history of the game.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I just shamelessly stole that and used it as a refrain in this poem. Just because I like the way it sounded, baseball in the Garden of Eden.
So, yes. Yeah, so some things you steal and some things you borrow.
That's right. Well, this book, just to go back to Diorama for a second, the epigraph of the book was to all the artists I've stole from and right. to my husband. And so I do a lot of stealing with credit. You know, I always give credit, but.
Right, yes. Right. So yeah. I don't know if, it, I mean, nothing, there's nothing new under the sun, truly.
Right. It's true.
Yeah. So it's like they say, how many plots are there in the world? You know, that everything is a handful of plots. Yeah. Just with some minor differences. I always find it amazing, like Shakespeare's plays are yes. all so similar.
Yes.
There's almost always like misidentified people, you know.
Yes. Yes.
Often gender, switching genders.
Yes.
And there's always a buffoon.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a royal duke or something. And there's often a storm or something that
yes.
Yeah. And
that
yet,
throws people off or makes them act different.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 And yet, even with all those similarities of plots between the various plays, it's the language that makes them so unique.
Yes. For sure. And I do think with something like this poem, for example, right? Like when we talk about baseball and why I'm using baseball to write a whole book of poems, it really is, it is baseball, but it's also not. It's a vehicle to express everything else, right? To talk about my relationship with my father, the relationship we all have with grief and longing and passion and feeling like something bigger than ourselves. To talk about religion and spirituality, to talk about that feeling of wanting to be immortalized in some way, you know, like all of those bigger themes, like it is about the baseball, but it's also not, you know, so definitely feel that.
Now, another thing that I noticed in the back of each book you show, you mention where the various poems were published previously in various literary journals and so forth. And it seems like almost every poem in Diorama had been published.
Yes. Yeah. And the same thing with IL 228.
Okay.
I think that's what you get for taking 10 years to write a book. Both of these books, I wrote them at the same time over the last decade. And it was kind of nice to have two projects to sort of go back and forth between. If I didn't feel like writing baseball poems, I didn't need to. I could go write poems about nature and about influences and everything else that Diorama is about. But yeah, like for me, I'm a little different than, I'm going to keep bringing her up, your last guest, and tell you that, you know, I publish with a university press, Texas A&M, and for them, you know, it's quite commonplace for like a literary poet to publish most of their book in magazines.
Right.
But it's been over the course of 10 years. So good luck collecting all of those magazines and trying to read the book for free. It's not going to happen. So
no, and over 10 years and what, at least 2 dozen publications.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. And some of them are defunct and, you know.
So what is it, I think I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you submit for your poems for publication, how you decide where you're going to send a poem and, you know, how you get so many published.
Well, I do send out a lot. And I will say the key is persistence. And no one likes to hear that because it's not sexy. But I probably have 20 or 30 submissions out at once all the time. And you know, if I get 2 or 3, 4 rejections, then I'm submitting to 3 or 4 or 5 new places. I usually find places to submit, like, I think, you know, Duotrope or Chill Subs or just online on social media. You can find places to submit. And a lot of these journals I've had long-standing relationships with. And by long-standing relationship, I mean they've been rejecting me for, you know, a long time. Or they accepted something a long time ago, and I'm trying to get back in. So I have my places I send to. And I think it's one thing in life that I don't take personally getting rejections from literary magazines. I'm a sensitive soul and I take a lot of things personally, but not that. You know, it really is a numbers game. And I've had poems published in places that I, you know, amazing publications that I never thought I would get into. And it's a poem that's been rejected 80 times elsewhere. And it's just like, it's all about style choice. It's all about finding the right editor. Because as I mentioned before, you know, I revise these poems till they're at the point where I say, there's nothing more that can be done. This is the best it's going to be, you know? So I have full faith when I'm sending them out. Like this is, you know, I'm not sending out drafts. So I'm working really hard and revising them really to an extreme, I would say. And then when I send them out, I have the confidence to just say, I'm going to keep sending it out until someone accepts, you know? I think people will say, oh, I have Excel spreadsheets and I have all this. I just use note cards on a ring to like write where I've, you know, submitted things out to. And then I pull the note card if I get rejected or accepted. And, you know, it's easy to do that way. But I do enjoy doing it. I do enjoy the audience. And I think for someone like me, I'm never going to sell books like Stephen King, right? So for someone like me, it's great to like get that feedback from readers. you know, to feel like the reader is interacting with the work. So especially because it's such a long process of publishing a book. So,
well, I recently interviewed Dennis J. Sweeney, I believe, and with his book, How to Submit to Literary Magazines and so forth. And a lot of what you're saying is exactly what, you know, you have to have a process and stick to it. And
yeah. It is painful for many, and it's still painful for me. Like if I go on a 6-month streak of not getting anything accepted or a year, you know, that sucks. And I really, you know, don't enjoy it, but
I bet
it's not going to be the end, but it's not going to be the end. Someone will accept something again, you know? So
well, Sandra, why don't you share another poem with us before we run out of time?
Sure. Let's do one more from aisle 228. Okay. Okay, I'll read this poem called Game 3, and it's nearer the end of the book. It has a little epigraph for the 2016 World Series. I kissed my father's cheek for good luck in the firehouse driveway. We were 27 outs away from a series lead when he entered through gate K. I took my seat on the Waveland curb and relayed Pat's play-by-play to guys in lawn chairs sucking booze through the scoreless game. Grandmothers perched as finches waited on my radio's say. The intersection bled into the ballpark's glow. From the streets below, we held the diamond aloft on our exhales alone.
And that was Sandra Marchetti reading from her book, Aisle 228. And maybe just one more short one.
Okay, I can do that. I have the perfect poem. I just need to find it. I know we're up against time, so. Okay. Where is it? 38. I haven't actually read from this book that much lately, so. Okay. Relish. My teeth break the casing, all vinegar and salt. I swallow the sweet bread, the ballpark steam, pans of hot water, mustard on plates, grated onions, please. America's game, feed me.
All right. So once again, you'll be in Iowa City, June 14th and 15th. So I guess I'm going to have to air this before then.
That would be great.
So that people will have a chance to come out and hear you and see you. And remind us again what you'll be doing.
I will be reading on June 14th and leading a free workshop for all writers on June 15th. And if you go to the Iowa City Poetry social media pages, I know they're on Instagram, Facebook, I'm sure they're elsewhere. All the details will be there on location and times. But I'd love to see folks at that event, at both of those events.
Of course.
Yeah.
And any kind of final words of advice for people who want to write poetry?
I think if you want to write poetry and you haven't done it before, or you've maybe messed around with it a little bit, revision is a key part of the process. Again, it's not sexy, but if you're just starting out, I think a lot of people like the idea of like scrawling something down and writing a draft. But going back and looking at that draft can sometimes be a scary confrontation. And you don't have to look at every draft again, but I dare you to go back and look and see what you can improve about it, because that's really where it goes from being catharsis to art. Is right, like your spontaneous emotion recollected in tranquility, like as Wordsworth, I'm paraphrasing Wordsworth, but you know, that idea of going back and revising. And I would say also the idea with poetry is get used to the long game as much as you can, whether it's the dozens of revisions that you might have to do or sending things out to, you know, many, many, many magazines before you get an acceptance. I think that's the key to success, really, is just, you know, find your people, but it's going to take a while. And be okay with that if you can be. If not, this might not be for you.
Do you do poetry, like open mic kind of things? And do you recommend that for people?
I don't really do open mics anymore, but I think that that's a great way. I do read in front of audiences. And for me, it's a great way to get feedback on things I'm working on. Poems that maybe I've just finished, and to talk to people afterwards about them. And I would say, especially if you're a person that reads that, like finds that that out loud and verbal feedback is useful for you, definitely do it. You know, I like to read my poems out loud just to myself to see, like, you know, do they sound right? Are they ringing true? So yeah.
Yeah. And you know, we sometimes, as when we were young, we thought all poems had to rhyme, and then then all poems didn't rhyme, and you know, but actually the rhythm of poetry is still very, very key.
It is. And I don't write typical metrical poetry. Like, I don't write sonnets or pantoums in the way that, you know, you might remember them from school. But I do write poems that have a beat, that have a rhythm. And to me, that's crucial to the enjoyment. Poetry is pleasure for me. And why are children's books so pleasurable to children? It's that rhythm. I mean, the pictures help too, but it's the rhythm. It's the rhyme. And I don't think we should shy away from that. I think there are ways we can do that that are not cliche, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Sandra, for being with us today. I'll close with the quote that you have at the beginning of Diorama from Louise Glück: at the end of my suffering, there was a door. And
thank
you. Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.